You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I find this fascinating. The graphic over at Daily Kos, I believe it is freedom of speech, RIP, maybe freedom of the press, a media blackout. Mayor Bloomberg, when he ordered the police into Zuccotti Park, also ordered the press out. There's a lot going on. Just got a note in our chat room. Benedict says, police riot in progress at Canal Street location. I don't have the details on that. There was no link. But let's check in with Anna Lekas Miller. Anna, am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, you are.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. A freelance writer, contributor at alternate.org. And Anna, do you have, you know, what's the latest on what's going on with Zuccotti Park? Anna? Hello? I think you're... There's your phone. Anna, if you could try that... Anna, we need to hear your audio on your telephone.
So in this occupation, which they're reinstating, they are rebuilding the kitchen tent. They're assembling the press. They have this legal hearing that's happening right now where... Uh-huh. The Bloomberg's eviction has been effectively deemed illegal by the National Lawyers Guild, and so that is being heard in court at the moment. Zuccotti Park, as it is completely evicted. There's absolutely none of the infrastructure that was once there, which is heartbreaking for many of us to see. And that's sort of the story right at this moment.
One of the leading hashtags right now is media blackout. What do you have on that?
What I have on that is I know people who were live tweeting the event who managed to get into the park last night and who were in a press pen. And in that press pen, they were effectively sanctioned off from what was going on in the actual park itself. And these were the lucky journalists who managed to actually get in. I know someone who is live tweeting who got escorted by the police away because they caught her with her phone. I know people who had media accumulating devices with them, like flip cameras, cell phones, etc. And these people were, their devices were confiscated, and they weren't allowed to keep taking media. So it was very much this very strange, odd 2 a.m. crackdown and complete silencing, or attempted complete silencing, that was happening.
So we have the billionaire mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, ordering the police to essentially create a media blackout on this. I mean, even NBC is reporting this, that they couldn't get their reporters in, and that their helicopter was ordered out of the airspace, apparently, which is quite remarkable.
Also a shot online of police effectively standing in front of news cameras and weren't allowing them in to see what was happening. So police are physically blockading them.
Right. So where is this going today, Anna? Do you know?
You never really know with these things. You never really know with the Occupy movement what turn it's going to take today. If you had asked any of us if this would happen 24 hours ago, no one would have known. What we do know is that we're going to listen to see the results of the legal hearing and wait on that, hopefully with a victory for our movement, and then really try to rebuild what we lost last night in another space, and also mobilizing for Thursday's action, which is occupying the New York Stock Exchange and really just filling the streets of Lower Manhattan with tons and tons of people. And in a way, like the police department has really been for such a long time, the police is our greatest PR mechanism, because these acts of brutality happen and really mobilize people who didn't necessarily see themselves in the movement beforehand. So November 17th will have a lot more people than anticipated.
Well, that's certainly what happened in Oakland, and that's why I was wondering if in your opinion, my guess is that what this is going to do, if this is perceived as an attempt to head off the movement, the action on Thursday against the New York Stock Exchange, or at least the occupying the streets of in front of the New York Stock Exchange, if not the Stock Exchange, that if this was an attempt to stop that, I think he just fed this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mayor Gene Kwan, in some kind of rambling remarks yesterday, let drop that she had been on a conference call before the crackdown started in Oakland a week or two ago, with 18 other cities that were experiencing similar situations to Oakland. That is, in other words, they had a substantial Occupy movement. This is the first city official who's come out and said that these things, these crackdowns across the country are coordinated. Thoughts on that? Information about that?
These coordinated crackdowns, it wouldn't put it past me. I'm sure that the police in various cities are exchanging ideas in the same way that occupiers in various cities are exchanging ideas on how to resist them.
Yeah.
I don't know anything official about police coordinating with one another, but it makes sense.
Okay, great. Anna, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And for the report. It's great to hear from you, and I appreciate your dropping in. Jackson in Washington, D.C. Hey, Jackson, what's on your mind today?
Hi, how you doing, Mr. Hartman? Yeah, I just wanted to know, what's your feeling about how the occupiers here in the U.S. are own U.S. citizens, and our government can't stand it, but our government occupies Iraq and Afghanistan for years.
Among others.
Yes. So how do you feel about that? It's a hypocrisy, right?
Well, when those people push back, we call it an insurgency and we crush it. But yeah, it is. And good point made. We have occupied the world and now it's coming back. Thanks a lot for the call. Tony in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, or KTLK. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Hey, good stuff, man. Good stuff. You know, my daddy was the president of LA, Los Angeles, NAACP back in the 50s. And yesterday I was listening to your show. I was a little boy. I think I was like 6 years old when this whole thing started. And we used to go to the meetings and we were really intense upon it. But I want our occupation colleagues to take a deep breath and understand that you have done your work. Now is the time to turn this thing into a point of litigation. Back in the civil rights day, it was what do we want? Freedom. When do we want it? Now. And those are the people sitting in at the Woolworth counters and marching in a nonviolent way, because with nonviolence comes sympathy. We become victims, and with victimhood, which is a very high honor, comes the sympathy of the world. Mm-hmm. We articulate that sympathy through litigation. Look what happened in 1964 with the Civil Rights Act. Look what happened in 1967 with the Voting Rights Act. Now it's time to really pinpoint, well, I want Glass-Steagall back. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Regulate the banksters.
We want
break up the big banks.
Yeah, we want regulation. You know, Bill Clinton did a lot of wonderful things, but he laid a couple of turds in the road when he left. And when we have NAFTA, which is ugly, but this Glass-Steagall removal, yeah. Man, that's the end of the world. And that was the precursor to Citizens United. You see, that's the precursor. It really, really laid the road, but. You know, we had this guy on the radio talking yesterday, on your show yesterday, talking about violence as an option. Please. I mean, really, please, my white brothers and sisters, I happen to be black, my white brothers and sisters, take a deep breath. Violence is the end of any occupation theory or movement whatsoever. We have to become victims. And with victimhood comes the sympathy of the world. And then we get the largesse of the people. Then
look at what happened in Egypt. For example, look at what happened in Egypt. People kept showing up. You know, the Mubarak kept shooting them. They kept showing up and showing up. You know, families bringing their kids, everything into Tahrir Square, and it brought down the government. On the other hand, you know, Libya, we came in with guns and bombs, and nobody knows how that's going to sort out. It's not. I think that's the difference that as Martin Luther King said. Violence embedded in something will lead to its end. Thank you, Tony.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, John Nichols. Is there a plot to sabotage the Walker recall up in Wisconsin? And some thoughts, of course, on what's going on in New York.
I never knew how much I loved Wisconsin till I stood in the Capitol Dome. Hundreds of thousands show people their power. So tell me, what are we gonna do?
Scotty, we're coming for you. John Nichols with The Nation is on the line with us from Madison, Wisconsin. Hey, John, welcome back.
It's good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you.
I should tell you, I'm talking to you from the east side of Madison, where State Representative Mark Pocan, who's running for Congress, has pulled together about 20 of his volunteers and supporters. They've got their maps, and they're putting his congressional campaign on hold for today and going door to door throughout the neighborhoods to try and get several thousand signatures out of his district. So that'll give you a sense of what's going on in Wisconsin.
Yeah, this is the let's get, 500,000 or 700,000? What's the goal, total number of signatures to recall Walker?
Tom?
Yeah.
Sure. It is officially, the goal is 540,000 signatures.
Okay.
But realistically, as you know and your listeners well know, that you have to overshoot. And so they're looking, basically the concept is to get around 700,000 signatures. That means that over the next 60 days, they need to gather 15,000 signatures a day. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, if what I'm looking at today is any indication, I don't think they're going to have a lot of trouble.
Okay. Very interesting. Thoughts on what's going on with the media blackout? Oh, before we get to that, I understand that there are Republicans bragging about the fact that they're going to themselves go around and take Walker petition, impeach
sure.
Walker, recall Walker petitions, and then destroy them. But that's a felony in Wisconsin. Is that just
Absolutely.
Braggadocio
yeah.
and it's just going to fade away, or was there actually some sort of organized attempt to do that?
Tom, there have been just about every possible dirty trick you can imagine. And it begins with yesterday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on the website that everybody in Wisconsin knew you went to get the petition. That's United Wisconsin. Their website was hit by a massive cyber attack. And the people who run their website determined that it was a denial of service attack, sort of a classic kind of thing that the Pentagon looks at as, a cyber attack. Hit by it, took the site down for the better part of 6 hours. And so you put that in combination with the very clear evidence, of people, it looks like Tea Party involved folks, communicating about how to, steal or take, petitions and then destroy them, potentially to go out and actually gather signatures on petitions, and then after getting those signatures, destroy them. There's a lot of, that's clearly afoot, and it's clearly a challenge. But I have to tell you, Tom, the fascinating thing is the counter to it. Last night on State Street in Madison, there were hundreds of people out, literally pouring out into the street with their petitions at 12:01. The first petition was certified at 12:42 a.m., all filled out and ready to go. And this morning we had reports there were dozens of people out in Eagle River, Wisconsin, in the far north, dozens out in Elkhorn, Wisconsin, at midnight. And so the bottom line is that despite the dirty tricks and the frustrations and all of the kind of parts of politics people don't like, the sense around the state today is much more festive. It's almost literally people coming to the door saying "Happy Recall Day."
Yeah.
So,
I think it's
working.
Yeah, this is what Ben Mansky told us last night, that it was basically people were having like house parties and block parties to wait until midnight so that they could sign the petitions.
Jamma parties. Yeah.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. John Nichols, your thoughts on what's going on right now in New York City and what happened overnight and the police. Excuse me, the media blackout that was imposed by the billionaire mayor in that city.
Yeah, I think it's really troubling in the United States of America that you would have evictions and raids going on at 1 or 2 in the morning. Let's be clear about that. That's the sort of stuff that you read about in novels about South American dictatorships or Europe in the 1930s. And we should not be cautious about calling it out. It's wholly inappropriate. And by the same token, I'm very pleased with a statement that came out from Danny Cantor of the Working Families Party in New York. It's been so supportive of Occupy Wall Street. And as Danny said, you can't evict an idea whose time has come.
Right.
And I do think that these over-the-top draconian and wholly inappropriate actions by authorities in New York are more likely to energize movements around the country than to tamp it down. As for the media coverage and the timing, look, clearly this was intended to, you know, create a nice little package where the park is cleared by the time anybody turns the camera on. But the reality is that we live in a new age, Tom, and you're a part of it. We have media that's being created by real people and committed folks, and getting this story out. And, you know, I always say we no longer have an alternative media in America. What we used to call the alternative media really is our essential media now. And the mainstream media that fails to cover these stories becomes increasingly irrelevant.
Well, even the mainstream media was apparently kept out. NBC reports that their helicopter was told to get out of the air, that, you know, regular reporters. In fact, a New York Times reporter got arrested.
Yeah, no, this is, and we've seen incidents like this all over the country. It happens that because
Mayor Kwan said that she was on a conference call with 18 other cities.
Yeah.
So this apparently is coordinated.
Because it's happening in New York City, people are paying a special attention to it, New York being a media center. But the thing that we need to be conscious of is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you had a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel photographer with her credentials and all of her cameras arrested. In Portland, we've had incidents in Seattle, all over the country, San Francisco, Oakland. And so it's very, very clear.
Hold on just a second, John. Hold on.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Okay, finish your sentence in 10 seconds.
I'm sorry. Political power would like to shut this story down. They would like it to go away. But the fact is, it is not something we're going to get rid of. You can't evict.
Amen. I'd like to see them spend a week living life out on the street. I don't think they would survive. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Jesse LaGreca is on the line with us. JesseLaGreca.org, his website. Jesse, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
You are on the street in Manhattan, and what's going on there?
I'm here at Jacotti Park looking at our territory wiped clean, shock doctrine style. Our library is gone. Apparently they threw it in a dumpster, so that's what they care about, education. Our kitchen's gone. Our medical care is gone. It's very frustrating. But at the same time, people are more determined now than ever. So, you know, out of every cloud, there's a single lining.
Yeah, it seems. And my guess was that this would, instead of shutting down what's going to happen on Thursday, this will probably amp it up. We'll see how that plays out. Have you had any contact with any members of the mainstream press or seen? I mean, is there? I understand a New York Times reporter was arrested. That NBC was told to get their helicopter out of the air. That billionaire Bloomberg did everything he could apparently to make sure that this revolution was or that this takedown was not televised.
You know what? It sounds to me like I just went on the Brian Lehrer show. I did Nicole Sandler. Obviously, Fox News doesn't contact me. CNN doesn't contact me. MSNBC doesn't contact me. I'm available if they'd like me to come on and tell my side of the story. I think it's very frustrating that I've literally gotten more press with the foreign press, who's not as concerned about, you know, telling the truth about America, as the American press. And to me, you know, I joke with people like, dear peasants, please pay no attention to the civilian uprising outside your window. If you sit tight and watch your TV, we'll have some lovely products for you to see in the next few minutes. To me, it's very frustrating because the media wants to create a narrative, not tell the truth. And, you know, I get frustrated because people in the media ask me, well, what's your title? And I say, well, I'm a protester, or an activist, or a freelance journalist. And invariably, I see organizer or leader. I'm not an organizer. I'm not a leader. I'm just one voice out of many. But my voice resonates with everybody else because we all have the same concerns. Right. The lack of accountability on Wall Street, the police state, the civil liberties that we obviously don't have that we thought we did. Right on down the line, we need a movement, and it's not going away because Bloomberg had a history.
Yeah, I got it, and I'm with you. And Jesse, it's fascinating how the media constructs a narrative and then looks for things to fit into it. Jesse LaGreca, Jesse, thanks for the update from Manhattan.
My pleasure and honor. I admire what you do, Tom.
Thank you. Ditto. Good talking with you. And in fact, the update from Zuccotti Park. We'll be talking with Jesse again as time goes on throughout the day. Scott in Los Angeles. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I just really love your program. Mate. I've been listening for a couple of years now and just find it so inspirational. So I want to say thank you, despite the fact that I know you don't like to hear the things, but thank you anyway.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
I wanted to toss just a comment about what I've been observing. And basically, I feel that we're sort of looking at the 1900s all over again. You know, I know it's a kind of a weird period in history, which never really gets taught in school, and most people don't understand too much. But so much of what is going on right now is like the mirror image of what happened in the 1900s.
You're talking about the progressive movement in the early 19-aughts and
19-teens? Yeah, exactly. Everything from, like, the reporting from people like Ida Wells and, you know, her expose on Standard Oil and the different lynchings that were going on around the country, which motivated and got everybody up out of their slumber and out in the streets, to you know, the interstate commerce clause, which broke up the transcontinental railroads, and
a president who was willing to enforce the Sherman Act. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt broke up Standard Oil, 29 companies.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, it's
just so ironic that here we are 100 something years later, and we're finding ourselves knocking right on the same doors of actually destroying everything that was created during that time, where, you know, unions were formed during that time. You had the child labor laws that were created during that time to protect children and actually have them go to school instead of, you know, sweatshops and factories and stuff. And it's the rhetoric from the right is all basically propagating the pre-1900s kind of philosophy of outlook on just pure greed and taking advantage of the populace.
Yeah. Well, this is a conversation that I tried to have with a conservative last night about how do you control and regulate the power of unregulated capital, of great wealth, if you don't have some mechanism to do it. And frankly, historically, what we've seen is that there are only two mechanisms that can do that. And one is the power of government, typically by taxation, and the other is labor unions. And that when you have both of those, when you have a high level of taxation on great wealth and you have strong labor unions, as we did in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s in the United States, then what happens is that the middle class grows at the same rate or even faster than the 1% grows. And when you do away with those things, as Ronald Reagan did, dropping the top tax rate from 78% down to 28% and kicking off a war against organized labor that has led to, you know, from 30% unionization to 8% in the private sector, what we've seen is the destruction of that middle class. Average household or average individual income now in the United States is in the 20s. It's like $26,000. And not only have you seen the destruction of the middle class, but you've seen an explosion of wealth, almost a 300% increase in wealth and income by that top 1%. And that's what I think, you know, that's what's bringing people into the streets, and that's it. Scott, thank you.
I agree.
Go ahead.
What's that?
Well,
what I was going to say, I just wanted to make one more point there, was the fact that I really feel that the Occupy movements would do really well if they're, I know you said that focusing on one issue or a couple of issues is not a good idea, but it seems like the average populace, you know, would be able to latch onto a concept if it was somewhat defined more than just a general sort of where it just.
Yeah, if I wanted to use polysyllabic words, I'd say it's the oligarchy stupid. But I think it's much easier to say it's the 1% stupid, and that's what we need to be doing. Scott, thank you for your call. Greg in Rancho Cucamonga. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How are you today?
I'm fine. What's on your mind, Greg?
I need to have some statistics. You know, I'm telling people that we are the 99% and 1% of the people are controlling things. I heard a few statistics. I hope you can help me. I'll have a pencil and paper. I heard that the 1% controls 25% of the income that comes into households. The 1% controls 50%. They own 50% of the stocks, that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. There's Mother Jones did a piece called How Rich Are the Super Rich?
Yeah.
And
how long ago I subscribe.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's pretty straightforward. The top 1%, let's see. I'm trying to convert this some graphs. They've got a bunch of graphs here, which is, let me pull those numbers together for you, Greg, and I will recite them a little later in the program. Well, I've got them
I'd
in
like
my
to
stack
tell you
here,
why
but I don't want to give
I need the information.
Yeah, because you're okay. Go ahead.
No, because I put a sign in my front yard. It says we are the 99%, and when people come and ask me what does this sign mean. You know, I got it from a website, your screener. I don't know if your screener would allow me to say the website.
Yeah, feel free.
That's my way of participating.
Okay, here we are. The top 1% of America owns 40% of the nation's wealth. This is from the Center for American Progress, this Think Progress blog. Top 1% of Americans owns 40% of the nation's wealth. They take home 24% of the nation's income. In 1976, by the way, they just took home 9%. They own half of the country's stocks, bonds, and mutual funds is the top 1%. They're taking more of the nation's income than at any other time since the 1920s. And it's a pretty good start right there. So anyhow, as we get more information, I'll pass it along to you, Greg. But thank you for the call on that. Kevin in Seattle. Hang on just a second. You got to push the buttons right. Kevin in Seattle. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you so much. We got some great news over here in Seattle in contrast to what's happening around the country.
Okay.
But first, I want to thank you because we've had a right-wing radio station that's had me on about three times. And thanks to you, I've sort of held my own in the water cooler wars. So to all you other Tom Hartman nerds out there that are sitting there soaking up this information, I want you to know that it can pay off in the end. But the Seattle General Assembly, Occupy Seattle, on the 28th of October, voted their very first what we'd call a demand, but we called it a call for Seattle City Council to divest its money out of the Bankster Gangster banks and into state and local banks. It wasn't quite worded that way. Mm-hmm. We presented it on the 31st, and 2 weeks later, yesterday, the Seattle City Council voted unanimously to support that proposal and to support the Occupy Seattle movement. It was an amazing, amazing display. We filled the room with people. The people got to speak for 2 minutes. Were so eloquent. It was amazing. And you can see it on the archives of Seattle City Council on November 14th, the full council meeting, if anyone wants to see.
That is spectacular. And Kevin, what that demonstrates is what, you know, I think history shows and what I've been raving about for years and years is that movement politics will drive party politics or political politics or electoral politics, not the other way around. Movements, strong, peaceful movements. And, yeah. You were going to say.
And I can only be a reporter. And it was everybody that made this happen. It was a thrilling, thrilling day here in Seattle.
Kevin, thank you very much for the report. And keep up the great work. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
By the way, the top 1% owns 40% of the nation's wealth. How much does the bottom 80% own? 7%.
The revolution will not go battle with coats. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be televised.
Well, and there's the counter-revolution as well. Michelle Bachmann telling us the kind of nation that she would like to see us become. Here is clip three, Jacob.
Go back and take a look at Lyndon Baines Johnson's The Great Society. The Great Society has not worked, and it's put us into the modern welfare state. If you look at China, they don't have food stamps. If you look at China, they're in a very different situation. They save for their own retirement security. They don't have AFDC.
They
don't have
money,
the modern welfare state. And China's growing. And so what I would do is look at the programs that LBJ gave us at the Great Society, and they'd be gone.
They'd be gone. Forget about Medicare. Forget about Medicaid. Forget about food stamps. Oh, you poor people. Don't you get it? You're supposed to be like Chinese peasants. I mean, out in the countryside, you know, dying at the age of 30 and having no health care. And it's like we're going to become like China. Yeah. Isn't that cool? That's Michelle Bachmann's vision of America. Turn us into a third world country, into a developing country. I mean, they are China is growing pretty rapidly, but they have a billion people. We have only 300 million. Really quite remarkable. Elizabeth Warren has come out with her first 60-second ad telling people who she is. And for our listeners in Massachusetts who, in particular, who may be voting in the election where she goes up against Scott Brown, who has now decided that the last minute that he kind of likes funding the Consumer Protection Bureau that she created. Scott Brown been all over the map on this. She's going to be challenging him for Ted Kennedy's old seat. Here's Elizabeth Warren's first 60-second ad.
I'm Elizabeth Warren. I'm running for the United States Senate. And before you hear a bunch of ridiculous attack ads, I want to tell you who I am. Like a lot of you, I came up the hard way. My dad sold carpet. And when he had a heart attack, my mom went to work so we could keep our house. We all worked. My three brothers joined the military. I got married at 19. Had two kids, worked my way through college, taught elementary school, and then I went to law school. For years, I worked to expose how Wall Street and the big banks are crushing middle-class families. It just isn't right. I stood up to the big banks and their army of Washington lobbyists. I worked to hold them accountable. I led the fight for a new agency to protect consumers, and we got it. But Washington is still rigged for the big guys, and that's got to change. I'm Elizabeth Warren, and I approve this message because I want Massachusetts families to have a level playing field.
Here's a person who I think could be one of the most effective United States senators that there is. And so I just want to shout out to Elizabeth Warren. I don't know how to say it beyond that. Over at Common Dreams, the Occupy Wall Street PR team, they're talking about the occupiers were chanting last night, "This is what a police state looks like." You know how they do it. This is what democracy. Tell me what democracy looks like. This is tell me what a police state looks like. This is what a police state looks like. New York City Council member Yanis Rodriguez has been arrested, was bleeding from the head, according to one text message. Another suggested that those not arrested yet at Liberty Square be chased up Broadway towards Chinatown. Basically, the mayor said. Well, actually, a police officer, reporter came up to a police officer and said, "Here I am. I'm a reporter. Here are my credentials." And the reporter said, "You're not a reporter tonight." In other words, the First Amendment, you know, that freedom of the press, that whole freedom of the press thing. Not going with a billionaire mayor. Sorry. Okay, to our calls. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Obama Sachs. That's what I'm calling him, Obama Sachs.
Armin.
Let me finish, Tom, please. You got to be like the right to censor everything you don't feel comfortable with.
Sure.
You know, the truth's not always perfect, Tom. Okay. Obama Sachs is socializing the Reagan-Bush, Clinton-Bush crime family losses and thefts by devaluing our currency and cutting Social Security and Medicare of the private sector working class taxpayers that bailed out Wall Street, while he's also piling up massive government debt.
Yeah, Armin, I can hear that on the Rush Limbaugh show. Thank you very much, though, for trying. Okay, back to what I was saying. This from the New York Observer reported that their photographers with credentials were barred from Liberty Square. They tried to get their I was saying an NBC News chopper. According to this, it was a CBS News chopper. Was ordered out of the sky. New York Times journalist Jared Malson went to jail in zip ties. And here's the crux of it. Here's where it kind of all comes together. The argument being made by the Occupy Wall Street folks, very simply, these are their words. We are engaged in a battle over ideas. Our idea is that our political structure should serve us, the people, all of us. Not just those of us who have amassed great wealth and power. We believe this idea resonates with so many of us because Congress, beholden to Wall Street, has ignored the powerful stories pouring out of the homes and hearts of our neighbors, stories of unrelenting economic suffering. Our dream for a democracy in which we matter is why so many people have come to identify with Occupy Wall Street and the 99% movement. And this is just bad. They say, as of filing this morning, with 100 people sitting in jail, a judge has declared that we have the right to return with our belongings. Those belongings, by the way, apparently loaded into dump trucks and taken off to the landfill. While Mayor Bloomberg insists that the park will remain closed, it does not matter. We will reclaim our streets block by block. We will occupy our public spaces everywhere, knowing that this idea cannot be evicted. And this is interesting. It was signed by J.M. Smucker, Rebecca Mansky, Karanja Gusasa, Linnea Palmer, Peyton, Kenine Holder, and William Jesse of the OWS PR team. Which, you know, seeing people's names on things says to me that this is getting, you know, step by step more and more organized, more methodical, more present. So, where are we going with this? Oh, and some of the headlines you won't read today, I'll share with you. This is great. I'll share this with you after the break. Stick with me.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. In our first hour, we heard several reports live from, you know, what's going on the ground in New York City, and also from John Nichols about what's going on in Madison with the Occupy the State of Wisconsin movement. take back the state from crazy Governor Walker. And we've been talking about the billionaire Bloomberg's efforts to keep the press out of Zuccotti Park last night, to the point of taking down, you know, just closing off the airspace so a CBS helicopter couldn't go in there. Basically, you know, the counter-revolution will not be televised sort of thing. And what the consequences of that are and what that means. In fact, here's the audio of this is what a police state looks like. This is what the protesters were chanting last night as the park was being taken down. Yeah, and over and over and over again, as opposed to this is what democracy looks like. Lawrence Walters is with us. He's with FirstAmendment.com and an attorney specializing in constitutional law. And Lawrence, welcome to the program.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. And I hope the same is true of you.
Absolutely.
You suggest that we've never seen anything quite like the Occupy movement, or at least it's never been tested in the courts. I would say that probably the Bonus Army in 1932 bore some startling similarities to this.
There have been some similar movements and, I suppose, comparable protests, but I stand firm in the belief that this is an issue of first impression for the courts, that we've never seen any nationwide occupation of public space as
right.
we are seeing now. And so, you know, the courts are wrestling with what this all means and how the First Amendment is impacted by the eviction efforts.
Right. And, well, in the Supreme Court at the time of the Bonus Army in 1932, when 45,000 people, you know, out-of-work vets camped from the White House all the way down to the Potomac, and ultimately President Hoover had Doug MacArthur, you know, ride through there with horses and 8 tanks. At that time, the Supreme Court was striking down things like child labor laws, saying that the right of a 12-year-old to contract was sacrosanct, and you know, to employment and you know, all sorts of things. I mean, it was a pretty right-wing court. To the best of my knowledge, the legality of the Bonus Army, or for that matter, the legality of what Hoover did, was never litigated before the court. Please correct me if I'm wrong. And that's, I'm assuming, the basis of your argument that this question of whether the occupation of public space falls under the rubric of the First Amendment, which says that the right to peaceably assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances shall not be abridged.
Right. That has not been tested by the courts, by the United States Supreme Court, certainly. You know, we certainly have within the Constitution the right to peaceably assemble, but the question is, when does that assembly have to end, if ever? And that is a question that has not been answered. You know, can one continue to assemble a group indefinitely in a public space and occupy that space for a an indefinite and infinite period of time. That is a question that we're, you know, that we're all struggling with as First Amendment lawyers, and I'm sure the courts will be for quite some time. You know, the government does have the right to impose time, place, and manner restrictions on speech, but when they do so, they have to provide for what are called alternative avenues of communication. In other words, they have to allow the speech to occur in some other place. So, you know, perhaps you can move these protesters around from place to place, but preventing them from assembling altogether is not something that the courts are going to tolerate.
Might we end up with, you know, given that the court might be looking at something like, okay, on the one hand, there could be permanent occupation of many public spaces, and yet these were intended as public spaces, and most of the public is not able to use them because they have food kitchens and medic tents and libraries and people sleeping in them. So they could be, the court could conceivably say, well, this, you know, is not a public space as envisioned as a public space. On the other hand, you know, you've got the First Amendment saying that the right to peaceably assemble shall, you know, that no law, Congress shall pass no laws to abridge that. Could this end up being, well, where, you know, how does that get parsed?
Yeah, the perfect you know, game out of that question would be if another group sought to use the same space, like the Tea Party.
Right.
And they petitioned or filed an application to conduct a protest or a rally in the same space as some of these Occupy movements. At that point, you know, the government would really be faced with a difficult question of, you know, can we continue to recognize this occupation as a form of expression? Must we do that? Or do we have to allow all groups to use the space on a rotating basis and come up with some sort of, you know, of licensing scheme that allows each group to have their voice heard in the space at any given time?
Now, if my memory of British history is wrong, please incorrect me. Please correct me. But if my recollection is that there was a corner in, as I recall, Trafalgar Square in London, where you could set up a soapbox and basically say anything without fear of arrest for criticizing the king, because that was the place, that was sort of the escape valve, the political pressure valve. That was the place where anybody could stand up and speak. And to this day, people are standing
still
in that.
Do it.
Yeah. Standing in that corner continuously and you know, doing everything from speeches about you know, how wonderful their wife is to the wonders of communism to you know, let's do away with monarchy. Might we end up with something like that? Designated free speech zones, essentially?
Well, that's already occurring on many college campuses and other areas that that face these competing requests for, you know, protests and rallies. And so the constitutionality of free speech zones is uncertain at this point. There have been some conflicting decisions among different courts as to whether these zones are constitutional in and of themselves, whether you can do it, or whether the zones that have been created are sufficient. What you have is a problem with separating the speaker from the intended audience. So if you say, okay, you know, out there in the pig field is your free speech zone, and you can go and talk about, you know, the bankers all you want, but they're never going to hear it, you know, that's not an effective free speech zone.
Right.
So to the extent you try to move a Wall Street protest away from Wall Street, there could be a very effective argument made by a good First Amendment lawyer that you are removing the speaker from its intended audience.
Are you anticipating being involved in this sort of litigation?
I suspect First Amendment lawyers throughout the country are going to be busy with this kind
Where does this start? Does it start in a local court, a federal court, an appeals court? Do you go right to the Supreme Court?
You don't have the right to ever go directly to the Supreme Court with this kind of case. It would start in either a local state court or a local federal court. You have the option of bringing First Amendment claims and civil rights claims in either state or federal court. Most lawyers go right to federal court because the federal judges are not as influenced by local politics as the state court judges.
Right, and that's what's happening right this morning in Manhattan, apparently.
Absolutely, yeah. And that they've gotten restraining orders. And, you know, that's fairly common when the court is faced with a First Amendment issue. The restraining order essentially preserves the status quo and lets everybody brief the issues for the court so that the court can make a decision.
Right. How do you preserve the status quo when the entire encampment has been destroyed?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And the, you know, the issue for the court is what was the status quo when, you know, the motion was filed, and if the speech was occurring at that time, then, you know, the status quo is put it back to how it was before.
Yeah.
And that's what they're doing now.
That's interesting. So the protesters may even have a claim of action, a tort, an injury of some sort.
Civil rights claim, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Lawrence Walters, the FirstAmendment.com, the website. Thank you, sir.
Happy to be here.
Great speaking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how much free speech is too much free speech? After this.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
Yeah, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Alex with Occupy the Road. Occupy Philly, Alex, right?
Yeah.
And you guys are on the road.
We're doing good.
Yeah, so give us an update. What's going on? First of all, the overview. What you're doing.
Woodland Avenue and 70th Street. I don't know the approximate mileage, but, you know, we're heading towards the airport area.
Mm-hmm. And this is the march from... You joined the march in Philly, but this is the march from New York City to Washington, D.C. Do I have that right?
Correct.
Okay.
And with a day off in at the Philly camp and a day off in Baltimore.
Okay. So how many folks are with you, and is it growing, and how's it going?
From what I heard, it started out with 22, mm-hmm. and we're up to about 40.
That's great.
So we had about 15 to 20 people join us at the Philly camp.
Mm-hmm.
And started our day walking by Independence Hall.
And that's appropriate.
And then went back. And that was kind of like an additional mileage, but everybody was up for it, you know.
Sure, Alex. What have been the high points of this for you?
Well, last night for me was pretty emotional night when we had the New York. Marchers that had just arrived from New York after about 4 or 5 days of marching, and they took a day off. And then at night, we a lot of the people in the Philly camp and then the New York marchers did not really get much sleep because we were up all night watching the live feed of the police raid at the Zuccotti Park.
Right.
And a lot of the New York marchers, you know, were, you know, pretty attached to that, and the Philly camp was attached to that as well. And with some of the press conferences of the mayor and the chief of police of Philadelphia, the Philly camp is expecting possibly a police raid. So the tensions were kind of pretty high last night.
Wow.
I heard about this New York to D.C. march, I definitely thought about joining it, and with everything that's going on at the Dilworth Plaza at City Hall and a upcoming construction project that's supposed to start today on the books, I felt appropriate to join this march and take it to the Capitol.
What's the significance of the construction project?
It was mentioned in the permit when they gave the permit to the Occupy Philadelphia, and it said that the permit would be for an undetermined amount of time until the start date of a $50 million construction project, including a skating rink and accessibility for disabled people
to
access the transit.
Yeah, and this is where the Occupy Philly is camped out, in other words.
Exactly.
Right.
And,
okay.
So everybody knew about this date coming up on November 15th. It's supposed to be the start of the construction date, and the meetings with the city have been pretty scarce, so they've been kind of slow progress. And the votes taken at the General Assembly at night, every time they voted on whether to stay or expand, everybody voted on staying.
Right.
At the plaza and making demands to the city. And once those demands were met, then to go to another permitted location.
Right. Okay. So how's that shaking out?
That's what's going on in Philadelphia.
Okay. So, is that situation in Philadelphia still in flux? Okay, Alex.
Exactly.
Alex.
Yeah, exactly. And the police there have been very cooperative. I've been there for about a month there, mm-hmm. helping out with the media and the music.
Yeah.
We had great music festivals. The vibe was real good. There was some issues just that, like there are any camps of the local population and some of the homeless population with high levels of theft and drug usage. And that seems to be that with unsanitary conditions, that seems to be the city's, the last thing that the city says is unsanitary and, you know, unsafe.
Right.
And that was the reason, you know, from what I heard, where Mayor Bloomberg called the police raid last night.
Right.
In Ducati Park. You know, using the usual tear gas and all this stuff.
Right. So right now, Philadelphia, the Occupy Philly, is awaiting the city's reaction, or has the city said?
Yes, exactly. They have approached the legal team, who's the working group that talks to the city.
Right.
And whenever the legal team gets information from the city, they present it back to the General Assembly.
Right.
Now the press conference with the mayor and the chief of police, who have been really cooperative up to this point.
This is in Philadelphia. Yeah.
Yeah, because that camp is going on about 40 days now, occupation. And very no police brutality at all in Philadelphia up to today.
Yeah.
No police brutality, just a few arrests being made here and there at some sit-ins and stuff like that, but no tear gas. The police escorts during the marches have been very cooperative as well.
Mm-hmm.
Philadelphia.
That's great. It's really interesting the different characters and natures around the United States of the different cities, and how the cities have responded to the Occupy movements, how the Occupy movements are responding to the cities. It's fascinating. But Alex, you guys are on your way here to Washington D.C. and from New York via Philly.
We're gonna hit the Camden, Delaware, and we got a lot of support. We got cars willing to drive our luggage while we march.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Alex, thanks a lot for the report, and good luck. Please give our very best to everybody there.
No problem.
Okay.
Have a good one.
Thanks, you too.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I got to tell you what's going on in Ohio. Governor John Kasich just took a whole pile of money from a particular industry, and guess what happened?
Counting on you to turn me around.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. I mentioned John Kasich on the way out. He got $213,000. Yes, he did. Well, his campaign, his political machine, from the oil and gas industry. And so what did he do? He said, hey, you want to frack public lands? Our public parks? Come on in, drill your gas wells. Start pumping those poisons into the ground. Yes. That's what John Kasich just did in Ohio. 70% of Ohioans, by the way, oppose fracking in their state. But John Kasich, what do the people care about? It's really remarkable when you think about it. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., our quote for the day, thank you, Sean, for this, few are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows, the censure of their colleagues, or the wrath of their society. Moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change. Each time a person stands up for an idea or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million different centers of energy and daring, those ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. Robert F. Kennedy. So, it's remarkable, remarkable, remarkable quote. Walter in Leesburg, Virginia. Hey, Walter, what's on your mind?
Hey, I have to ask a question. That Keystone Pipeline they want to put through, is that going to have any security?
It would be impossible to secure, you know, something that goes all the way from the northern border to the southern border. You'd have to, it would cost, I mean, you think that putting guards along the Mexican border is expensive and impractical? This is an even longer distance.
Yeah, so what I'm saying, is this going to be below ground or above ground?
I don't know. I'm assuming it'll probably be both.
Because that's crazy. That's literally saying, here, come and attack this.
If there's
not going to be any security, I mean, that'll be an environmental disaster.
Right. Terrorist target number 34. It's like, you know, that and the cooling pools around our nuclear plants. You know, when we learned that Mohammed Atta had originally planned on hitting the nuclear plant outside of New York City and ultimately decided not to because he said that he believed that it was surrounded by surface air missiles. Turns out it's not. It wasn't then. It still isn't. And that would have rendered New York City sterile. And so it's like, yeah, we've got a lot of targets around this country, and it's a terrible thing. And they want to add more to it. I don't. It makes no sense. It makes no sense. Walter, thank you for the call. Well said. John in Pennsylvania, do I have it? John?
Yes.
I don't have a city for you. I'm sorry. I have a 570 area code. Where are you calling from?
Yes, it's Stonestown, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It's in Sullivan County.
Yeah, okay. So what's up?
All right. You know, it's interesting that this is following up what's going on with the governor in Ohio with his, fracking legislation there. We have the same thing, as you know, going on in Pennsylvania. I've met and spoken with Josh Fox a few times on this, and I know he's spoken with you.
Yeah, he was on our show yesterday.
Yes, he was. What is going on right now is there are two horrific bills that are now being voted on as we speak in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives and the Senate. One is Senate Bill 1100, which is essentially a model statewide zoning ordinance which removes the authority or the right for any municipality to regulate, control, or enact any zoning regarding gas and oil development, and it supersedes any previous zoning that is in place. In other words, the people no longer have a voice.
Right.
It's going to be in our towns, whether we want it or not, whether we like it or not, and we have nothing to say about it. Another bill is 1950, which is a House bill, but both of these had preliminary votes yesterday and passed and went to appropriations, and there's some rewording, and they're going to have a final vote on it today. 1950 does essentially the same thing. The municipalities, county commissioners, township supervisors, mayors will no longer have anything to say. It is essentially, no matter how you slice it, statewide eminent domain.
Wow.
That's what it's going to mean.
On behalf of the oil and gas industry.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this only deals with oil and gas legislation. They also tried something like this, I think it was about a year ago, with the CAFOs, the commercial agriculture.
Right. Please refresh my memory. Which party controls your governor's office and your two houses of parliament, of Congress, your House and Senate?
I think it's the corporate party. No, it's the Republicans.
All three branches.
Yes.
Wow.
And not that it seems to matter, because it was the Democrats who invited the industry in under Governor Rendell.
Yeah.
They invited them in. The Republicans laid out the red carpet when they got here, and the Democrats are not standing up against this. All they're saying is, well, then, can we tax them? Can we get money out of this?
Right.
That's it. I mean, neither party has come forth and taken.
Is there any kind of popular movement among the people in Pennsylvania, John, to push back on this?
Absolutely. I mean, there have been there are organizations such as Responsible Drawing Alliance in Williamsport. There's Gas Drawing Alliance in Luzerne County. Damascus Citizens for Sustainability. There are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of people across this state who, you know, have formed organizations, Delaware River Keepers,
right,
which is also part of Senator Robert Kennedy's organization, have all come out against this. Now the Pennsylvania Municipalities Organization has come forth and says, we don't want this. We do not want you to remove the right for us to zone and regulate oil and gas drilling in this state. And our legislators just essentially thumbed their nose and said they don't care.
Yeah. Wow.
That's just about the way it is.
Well, John,
I live in Sullivan County. We are now considered what is called a sacrifice zone. And it's just
meaning that the dredge, the effluent, the waste goes into your county. Is that
pretty much? There's also another bill that a permit rather that's been applied for through the DEP, which the DEP looks like it's going to approve, and that would be tomorrow, and that's for them to spread brine water, which is produced water from the drilling operations,
right,
onto our roadways for de-icing and dust control. And this even goes as far as state parks. Another piece of legislation is HB 367, which is going to remove the authority to lease land to the gas and oil industry from the prisons and the school system.
Wow.
And put that under the state's control, where universities, school districts, prisons, anything like that, state public parks will no longer have a say in whether they engage the industry or not. It's going
remarkable.
To be forced on them.
Remarkable. Well, John, you've done a great job of summarizing this for us and for all of our viewers and listeners, and thank you very much for that. I appreciate it. And I wish you the very best. Keep us up to date on how things are going on that. That's extraordinary. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Well, thanks for letting me talk with you. I appreciate all you do, Tom. It's
Thank
a
you.
Good discussion you're having. It's important. Our country has been taken over by the oil and gas people. And
yeah, it started with John Rockefeller in the
1890s.
Yeah.
And you've written about this. You've spoken about this, how we're going to rejuvenate our manufacturing economy with hemp. And what's going on in the public perception in that realm is not being discussed. We have no solutions to go towards.
Well, we do. We have solar, we have biomass, you have geothermal, you have wind, you have wave power, you have, as you mentioned, biological things like hemp, growing hemp. And in Germany they use, it's called rapeseed, I think it's called canola here in the United States.
Yeah. It's illegal.
No, I know.
And so we don't have the solutions to go forward with because it's illegal.
Well, all of those are legal except for hemp. And you're right. Hemp is illegal, and it is the most efficient converter of sunlight into biodiesel that exists, and one of the most efficient converters of sunlight into cellulose that exists. And,
do you know any American farmers who are growing hemp today?
Well, I believe that they may be doing it in North Dakota, but I may be wrong.
How come
on that.
It's so hush-hush?
I'm not sure, frankly.
Why isn't progressive television bringing this issue up in the face of the oil monopoly right now?
Okay, well, that's a good suggestion. Let me get on it. I'll see what I can learn. Robert in Columbia, Maryland. Hey, Robert, what's up? Oh, hey, Robert. I'm sorry, we just hit the break. I'll be right back with you. Hang on. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman program, and putting aside, by the way, Republican talking points, environmental regulations cost jobs. That's the Republican talking point. The University of Massachusetts looked at this and they said, no. If the EPA regulations were to go into effect requiring scrubbers, it would create 250,000 new jobs.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, somebody has to build those things. They have to design them. They have to install them to clean up the air coming out of the smokestacks. Lots of jobs.
From the tops of the buildings to the streets below, between the Wall Street banks and the empty homes, between the lines of the people standing all in a row, there's a crack in the gutter where a flower grows. Reminding me that everything is possible. Yeah,
9.5 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk media for the sane among us. And in the studio with us, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by the way, by Ellen's charity for the Sudan, goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Goatsfortheoldgoat.org. I'm the old goat.
Yeah, there you go. So, Ellen, what's up?
Okay, well, it's very interesting. They are looking at a National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act. Now, they're saying that somebody who
The Republicans in the House.
They're saying, okay, well, if you have a gun and in one state, why shouldn't you be able to bring it into the other state as long as you obey that other state's laws?
Right.
Okay, well, obviously there's a lot of people that could get in under that because one state is not necessarily so good about tracking who a felon is, et cetera, kind of thing. Well, Congressman Jim McGovern went bananas. He said, look, they have us, you know, deciding on abortion. They have us doing this. People want, and he said, J-O-B-S. he was very, very funny. He was very vocal about it on the floor today.
Well, maybe Smith & Wesson will hire a couple extra people.
It's really, and he said, people did not bring us here to try and make gun carrying across state lines an easier kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's H.R. 822, and the Rules Committee voted down a resolution by Jim McGovern to consider the bill under more open rule, and Congressman Nadler of New York said that the Rules Committee rejected some amendments offered by Democrats, including an amendment which would have prohibited a known or suspected terrorist from carrying a concealed firearm.
So for the Republicans, jobs, no. Known terrorists carrying concealed firearms, yes.
Yes, that's exactly right.
That's like a TV ad waiting to happen.
I mean, right. The Republic, Jerry Nadler should just get up and show the clip of him trying to, well, of course you can't do that in a campaign advertising. It's against the House rules, but.
Really?
Yeah. You can't use things from the floor in a campaign advertising.
Oh, that's a shame.
But I know. We'd have a field day with that. Okay. Yeah. Some other thing. The budget is divided instead of this huge omnibus. You and I have talked about that to three mini buses, as they've called it. The first one looks like it will be negotiated between the House and the Senate. The House passed it. There are some questions about restrictions on NASA's relationship with China, which some people want to put on. As you know, we're having to hitch rides now for NASA with Russia and some other countries, mainly Russia. But now the Senate today is looking at the minibus, too. They're going to be taking a look at that. And a part of the minibus one rule would be that the government does not turn into a pumpkin on November 18th. It goes into mid-December. So they're just sort of kicking the can down the highway because they haven't managed to come up with a budget.
This isn't a one-year budget. This is kind of a continuing resolution sort of thing.
That's right. Now, by the way, it's interesting that Harry Reid got on the floor. Now, not often does the Senate Majority Leader get on the floor today, on the floor at all, but he got on the floor, and he went after the Republicans on regulations. He said there's plenty of evidence to prove that those regulations save lives, prevent asthma, et cetera. There's plenty of evidence to prove that disasters like BP and the financial crisis of 2008 could have been prevented by stronger government watchdogs. And then he quotes Bruce Bartlett. I don't know if you remember. I remember from Ronald Reagan days. He sort of did a little bit of appearance in the Bushies. He was a Treasury official under George Herbert Walker Bush. And he said, no hard evidence is offered for the claim that these regulations get in the way of making
business.
Jobs business. Yeah. He said it's simply asserted as self-evident and repeated endlessly throughout the conservative echo chamber.
Amazing.
This is a Republican, a Reagan Republican.
Well, the University of Massachusetts just released a study showing that just the new EPA regulations to scrub, the air clean would create 250,000 new jobs. Because somebody has to design the scrubbers, somebody has to install the scrubbers, somebody has to maintain the scrubbers. So regulations actually create jobs.
Right. Well, I mean, look at the regulations that have to do with the curb cuts and all that kind of thing. Yeah. Those all created jobs, the door handles, all of that.
Yeah, interesting.
So that's interesting. Also, the Senate Democrats today, particularly Tom Udall of New Mexico, he said that they don't know that the super committee can meet the deadline of the 23rd of this month. As you know, the people in the Defense Department are saying, oh, no, if it goes into a cut, it's going to be a disaster.
Hmm.
It's beyond me on that front. Let's see, one other interesting thing. A U.S. drones killed 7 people in Pakistan today, and they said it was in the North Waziristan area. They said they were militants, but, again, that's just that kind of
thing. We don't know.
Whatever. Other thing, in Iowa, they had an energy forum. I guess it was done by Politico. They actually got 22 climate scientists who are in Iowa, who work at the university and other places, to say that climate change is hurting Iowa and is causing Iowa a lot of problems. They delivered a petition to Governor Terry Branstad, and they are saying that there's clear connections to global climate change.
Wow.
So
this, while now even Mitt, who at one point acknowledged global climate change, has now gotten on the bandwagon of, I don't know,
and of course the Democratic Party has this thing that they put out pretty regularly called Which Mitt?
Right.
Which is great. Also, as you know, the Occupy Wall Street people are still active. My sister-in-law was down there very early this morning, around 5 o'clock in the morning, as a lot of this was going on. But there's some other things that I think this has spurned. Today, citizens of the state of Maryland actually went out, and they are presenting a Health Care Affordability Act to their legislature. They've gotten like over 200 organizations involved in this, and they're taking matters in their own hands. They're not saying, well, we're not going to wait for the Supreme Court and their Obama, you know, one way or the other. They are actually trying to do it on a state-by-state basis, too. So it looks like Occupy Wall Street has some legs, as they say.
That's great. That is great. Ellen Ratter with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. And brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Up next, thank you, Alan. Thank you so much. Up next, Gordon Brinser with Solar World, how to bring our jobs home. Mr. Brinser.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do we bring jobs to the United States? How do we keep jobs in the United States? We invented the vacuum tube. Pretty soon, radios were being made all over the world. We invented the transistor. Pretty soon, we invented the integrated circuit. We invented a lot of solar technology, and now we're importing a lot of solar technology. What's the deal? I wanted, and in the midst of this, you know, of course, there's this huge manufactured scandal that Daryl Issa is trying to pump up in the House of Representatives about a solar company that had some government-backed loans. And, oh, my God, the Obama administration might have had something to do with that. Less than 1% of the total loan portfolio of, I believe it was the Energy Department, and, you know, that went down. And we were talking about this and looking at this, and, you know, where can we find somebody who really knows this stuff? And then I came across this. Gordon Brinser, shown in this is in the Business Journal, this article, showing with Senator Lisa Murkowski and Senator Ron Wyden, you know, one of the front men in the trade dispute with China, and Solar World is an advertiser on our show, disclosure. But I thought, wow, we've got a resource right here. So Gordon Brinser, who I have not met or talked with before, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Gordon is the president of Solar World USA. SolarWorldUSA.com is the website. Chinese government has provided $30 billion in subsidies to its homegrown manufacturers, its solar manufacturers last year. And is this number accurate out of this article?
Yeah, it is accurate. And in fact, it's probably pretty conservative from all of our accounts. And we've provided everything to the Commerce Department. And what's amazing about those subsidies is that it's really focused upon them developing an industry specifically for exporting their product overseas. And they've done little to basically grow any type of solar industry demand in their own country.
So that's pretty amazing, because I've heard stats that China is the largest manufacturer of solar panels now in the world, but that's an export industry.
It is clearly an export industry. They've only, I believe this year, they'll install maybe 500 megawatts of actual solar in their own country, yet they have over 16 gigawatts, or that's about 16,000 megawatts of manufacturing capacity. And that's really focused their intent, and they've been very clear about it in the media, and their public statements by their executives come out and say their intent is to own the U.S. Solar industry. So they've focused their exports on the U.S., on Europe, mainly to, you know, put out of business a lot of U.S. companies.
Now, this is not, this is new, relatively new with the solar industry, because the solar industry itself is relatively new. But ever since the 80s and the 90s, when we went into this, you know, we had tariffs in this country from 1783 until the 1990s. And that said, you know, if there's a dollar's worth of American labor in a pair of shoes made in Connecticut, and you want to import a pair of shoes like that made in China where it might be 30 cents worth of labor, or made in Mexico where it might be 50 cents worth of labor, there'll be a 70 cent tax at the border if it comes in from China, or a 50 cent tax at the border if it comes in from Mexico, to level the playing field. And not just for labor, but for environmental standards and other things like that. And that's why we made socks in the United States, and shirts and jeans and computers and TVs and all kinds of things. And then we blew all that up in the 90s with this so-called free trade mania. And the Chinese government, Chinese are just walking in through this door, are they not?
It's a wide open door for them. There is really no barriers or hurdles for them to get into the solar industry in the U.S. And what's even more amazing is that labor is only 10% of the actual cost of solar manufacturing. So there is no warranted cost advantage that the Chinese have. They literally, this is just dumping of their products through their legal subsidization practices. So in many cases, as you pointed out, there could be a labor advantage. In this case, there is none.
Wow. So this is
a low percentage.
So what this is a case of they're saying, okay, if we put all these other companies out of business around the world, then we will own the marketplace, and then we can raise the prices to make it profitable.
That is correct. Their intent has been made very clear. If they own this new renewable energy sector, energy is, as we know, it's the bloodstream of our economy.
Sure.
And I honestly believe that China sees this as a very strategic maneuver for them politically, and environmentally, and from a economic standpoint.
Right. They want to become the ExxonMobil of the solar industry, I guess.
No,
or they want their companies.
Exactly. Right now, we rely on the Middle East for our fossil fuel sources, mm-hmm. our gas. We're fighting wars over there. Soon, if we continue to let this process go down the path that, you know, China is pushing it, we will be dependent upon the Far East for our solar products.
Right. So what are you and I guess there's this coalition that you guys have put together. Originally, there's 125 members now. It was smaller than that before. Many United Steelworkers and other unions are on board. What are you all calling for? This is the if I have this right, it's calling itself the Coalition for Affordable Solar Energy.
That is clear. There's a coalition.
Oh, that's what came out in opposition to your efforts.
There is an opposition out there. It's a very small opposition. The Coalition for American Solar Manufacturing has asked the Department of Commerce to basically initiate a case, which they did last week, which does two things. One, it does the initiation by Commerce sends a very strong signal that our concerns are valid and significant enough to warrant an investigation, and also validates that the coalition represents a majority of the domestic industry. And as a coalition, what we're asking for is we want a sustainable and fair global competition. What we have now is a foreign industry that is completely out of balance and focused on exports, and as a result has created significant harm to the U.S. industry. We at SolarWorld, we've been able to compete globally on a global platform for years, and we want to continue with that global competition and have a very vibrant U.S. industry around global competition, but it's got to be fair and sustainable practices. And as you mentioned previously, what China is getting away with today, both from a business perspective, is not sustainable. From an environmental perspective, is not sustainable. We are held by different standards. The people in the United States and worldwide have said, okay, for businesses to be sustainable and to be fair, there's a certain set of standards from business practice, environmental standards that we have to uphold to, and China's not being held accountable to those same rules of the playing field.
Yeah, but really this is a very old game. I mean, back in the 1880s and 1890s, John Rockefeller, when he was running, when he basically owned the oil businesses in Pennsylvania and Ohio, he would drop the price of kerosene, was the principal oil product at that time. He would drop that price below his own manufactured price in order to drive out of business all of his small competitors. And then once he'd driven them all out of business, he'd jack the price back up to whatever he wanted. And ultimately, that led to, you know, the enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act and Teddy Roosevelt breaking Standard Oil up and whatnot. But China's playing that game now.
Yes, they are. And I think what's very interesting is there's been reports out that the U.S. is a net exporter of raw material and equipment into China for the solar industry. And they're even in the process of taking over the raw material refining also. So it's not just going to stop with the solar manufacturing or the manufacturing of the actual solar product itself. You're seeing now where they're starting to take over the raw material refining in right. solar, and also the equipment manufacturing in solar will soon follow. So the jobs in the U.S. will slowly disappear from the manufacturing sector of the industry, and that's a huge concern for us. We have 1,000 employees here in Hillsboro. They do a fantastic job. We've been manufacturing for 35 years on U.S. soil, and our intention is to keep manufacturing, keep those jobs here in the U.S., and grow those jobs in the U.S.
Yeah. Gordon Brinser, the president of Solar World Industries USA, solarworldusa.com is the website. Thank you, sir, for the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
And keep it up. I mean, this is something we should all be contacting our legislators about and saying, hey, you know, we need manufacturing in the United States.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. Not a chance. Don't even think about it. Welcome back. Sarah Jaffe is with us. She is a writer with Alternet, actually the associate editor with Alternet.org. And Sarah, welcome.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Just great. You have an update for us on the latest from New York. What's going on?
Well, I wish I had an official update, but I've been sitting in a hearing room for the last hour and a half listening to them debate the temporary restraining order that was actually filed this morning about, I think, 6:30 this morning. A judge granted a temporary restraining order that supposedly said the protesters were allowed to stay in the park. Of course, they'd already been cleared out at 1 a.m. And when I was down at Zuccotti at about, I think, 11-ish before coming up here, the cops had occupied the plaza themselves and put up barricades, and nobody was allowed back in. So what they're arguing, what they have been arguing here, is in effect that they should be allowed back in with tents, with their camping gear now.
And what's the what direction are the arguments going? What's your sense of how this thing is going to play out?
So the judge that granted the temporary restraining order has done work with the ACLU. People have told me that she is a very good on First Amendment issues. She was not the one who was in charge of the hearing. That was Judge Michael Stallman that we were in front of. Brookfield at one point, this was the last line of the morning, was towards the end.
Brookfield, if I may interrupt, Brookfield is the private corporation that owns the park.
Brookfield is a corporation that owns the park that Mayor Bloomberg's girlfriend, Diana Taylor, is a member of the board. But it was actually, this was actually the lawyer for Mayor Bloomberg. This was not the lawyer for Brookfield.
Okay.
Who said, and I do believe I quote, it's hard for us to get served with papers at 4:45 this morning. And the lawyer for the protesters, in effect, said, Well, you shouldn't evict them at 1 a.m. then.
Yeah.
The claim was that the city never received the restraining order, and meanwhile the lawyers for the protesters were saying that the only complaints that were in the order that they gave before the cops moved in were dated today.
Right.
As in the November 15th. So either they, wrote them at 12:01 or they may have backdated them.
Hmm.
So some interesting stuff going on there. The judge said he will have a decision by 3, and hopefully it goes in the protesters' favor.
Yeah. So this is going to be an interesting one. We'll keep an eye on it. Sarah, any other updates you have for us, or is that?
No. The issue here is the tents. The Brookfield is saying they're perfectly happy to have people in the park 24/7 exercising their First Amendment rights. And the issue is going to be whether they're allowed to bring back any of the infrastructure that they had with them.
Right, the physical infrastructure.
Also, whether the cops are going to get out of the plaza anytime soon.
Right, okay, very interesting. Sarah, keep us up to date. Look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you very much, and thanks for calling in with the report. Amazing. Robert in Columbia, Maryland. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to help out with updates on Occupy Wall Street and give some information on Occupy D.C.
Okay.
The police are still in the park. Not letting the protesters back in.
Right.
And early in the morning, amongst the 200 protesters that were arrested, Manhattan Councilman Rodriguez was arrested as well.
Right.
And that's been reported in the Daily News.
Yeah. Yeah. We've mentioned that. Okay. Very good. Okay. Thank you very much, Robert. I appreciate it. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yes, I just wanted to thank you for having this programming, and I have recently become a supporter of Free Speech TV, and the reason I am is that I used to be very much a supporter of public radio. Mm-hmm. Wherever I've lived, and I've been here now 20 years in Minneapolis, and I would say that Minnesota Public Radio does an incredibly poor job of covering anything that is not, is going to be too controversial.
Yeah.
And
ever since Congress started cutting their funding back during the Reagan administration, they have increasingly been relying on major corporate donors. And so,
right. Yeah. And so they're just nothing more than corporate media, except a little more sophisticated. And they claim that you do advocacy journalism, but actually, I would like to hear full political spectrum,
yeah.
And I've listened to their program very carefully, and I've complained to them, and there are certain people that they just would not have on there. William Grider is one of them. Yeah. I don't believe they've ever had Naomi Klein on. I'm talking about Minnesota Public Radio programming, not
right.
necessarily.
John, I'm going to stop you, and thank sure. you for the call and for your concern, but try not to get into conversations about the individual radio stations or television stations that we're on. I don't want to get into a critique of one particular station or network. I can give my critique of NPR, which I think I did, but let's move along. Tracy in El Sobrante. Hey, Tracy, what's up?
Hi, I was listening earlier, and you were talking to someone about the legal, the right to the occupiers to occupy, and
right.
This is a story from the Vietnam era. My mom told me about it. There was a guy in Walnut Creek, California, who had this really huge peace sign on his building, which was a really big building, and you could see it from, like, all over. And the city council and stuff said, you can't keep that up there. That's, it's political. It's upsetting people. And he said, but it's a seasonal decoration. And they said, he says, if you guys can have Christmas stuff, like giant snowmen and Santa Claus and whatnot,
right.
lights, then, I should be able to have mine up too. And they said, well, what's the season? And he said, the season is the war in Vietnam. As long as the war is going on, that's the season. So I don't know how that applies to, like, people, but if their stuff is, like, part of the occupation, part of the speech, that they should be able to stay there for the season.
And have their stuff, yeah. And the season is as long as the banksters are ripping us all off.
Exactly.
Yeah, Tracy, very well said. I'm sorry to cut you off, but it's the end of the break. We'll be right back, 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, more of your thoughts on what's going on in the United States and around the world, and the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word, ugly. Music must mean that it's time for the good, the bad, and the very, very dycophobically ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. One Wisconsin now. The Progressive Group is spearheading the Governor Scott Walker recall effort with a campaign appropriately called Occupy Walker. The purpose of the campaign is, quote, to publicize the disastrous policies of the pro-corporate, anti-middle-class Scott Walker administration, end quote. One Wisconsin Now and a slew of other groups have 60 days to collect the 540,000 signatures needed to trigger a recall. You can find more information at onewisconsinnow.org, O-N-E, wisconsinnow.org. So get out there and collect some signatures. The bad, Herman Cain, the pizza man who is pretending to run for president, is once again suffering from foot and mouth disease. In a recent interview, Cain again echoed the often debunked Islamophobic claims that a majority of Muslims hold extremist views. Speaking with GQ, Cain said, I have had one very well-known Muslim voice say to me directly that a majority of Muslims share the extremist views. When pressed on whether or not he thinks that claim is right, Cain said, yes, because that's his community. That's his community. I can't tell you his name, but he's a very prominent voice in the Muslim community, and he said that. Right. The old I can't tell you where I heard it, but I heard it thing. Made famous by Michelle Bachmann when she said someone, she couldn't say who, but someone had told her that HPV vaccine can give children brain damage. This shouldn't surprise us too much coming from Cain, who admitted he got his entire 999 plan from, quote, some guy in Cleveland, end quote. So how much longer do we have to take the Cain train seriously? And the very, very ugly, the Bank of America. Even though the mega bank walked back its plans to impose a $5 debit card fee, they are hard at work stealing from the poor. 41 states across the country have contracted with big banks like Bank of America to administer unemployment benefits, meaning the state will deposit the benefits in a bank account and the recipients will have to use a debit card to collect them. And in South Carolina, Bank of America is charging fees for people to collect their benefits, fees as high as $5 a pop. Those fees are crippling people like Shawana Busby, who collects $264 a week in unemployment but has paid over $300 in fees to Bank of America. The bank has profited millions of dollars off similar fees to similar unemployed Americans. No wonder why 650,000 Americans have moved their money to local credit unions, because the way the banks behave is very, very ugly. Just a quick FYI, also, there's a march today in D.C., today, November 15th, from McPherson Square Park at 5 p.m. They will be marching to show solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street folks. So, just a heads up on that. So, 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Scott in Skowhegan, Maine. Am I saying that right, Scott?
Yeah.
What's up?
Hey, I don't have, like, a constitution in front of me or any of the writings, but I believe in there. It's either in the Federalist Papers or in the Constitution itself that it says that if the government becomes dysfunctional or no longer works for the people, that the people have a right to dismantle it.
Yeah, you're talking about actually the Declaration of Independence. And in one place it says they have the right, and in another place it says they have the duty to overthrow such
exactly.
a government. Yes.
Well, I think we've reached that point. I really do. And I'm just curious to know what you have to say about it. I'll take it off air.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Scott. Here are my thoughts in a nutshell. I think that, yes, our government has become captive to a large extent, to such a large extent that it's functionally captive of the oligarchs, of the business roundtable, the 100 largest corporations in America, of the Chamber of Commerce, and of a small handful of very, very wealthy and cranky right-wing billionaires. There are some, you know, billionaires on the left who are pushing back. There are average working people who are pushing back. There is a large movement pushing back. The Declaration of Independence, however, was a declaration of independence from another country. We were saying the North American continent is not going to be part of the British Empire any longer. I don't think we can declare independence from ourselves. So I wouldn't look to the Declaration of Independence to say that it is our right or our duty to overthrow that form of government that has become oppressive, because I think it's our right and our duty to infiltrate and take over and change that form of government, which has become so badly corrupted. So I see this not so much as a call to revolution, like I know some of the people in the militia movement do, where they're storing their guns and their food and whatnot. And I see this as a call for political action, a political activism, you know, to get out there and get active. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle with an update on Occupy Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's going on there?
Hey, Tom. Well, we're a shout out definitely to our brothers and sisters in New York City at 3:30 in Seattle at the Seattle Central Community College. There will be a solidarity march with those on at Occupy Wall Street. We have a situation here where actually our city council voted and unanimously to endorse Occupy Seattle, not only to endorse Occupy Seattle, but to endorse the majority of our demands, which at this point have to do with where our public money is being held. We're actually asking the city to review where all of the tax money is being held in the state, and we're pushing these ideas of a publicly owned state bank. Get that money out of the corporate banks and stop sending it to Wall Street and keep it in our local community. That's one of our demands at the Occupy Seattle movement, and our Seattle City Council voted unanimously yesterday to endorse our proposals. So there's an example of what you were just talking about our group basically moving into our local city government and trying to reform it from the inside. And it looks like we have 9 members of the city council who want to work directly with us on that, which is great considering that as of last week, we were getting really bad local corporate media press here.
Yeah.
And the president of Seattle City or of Seattle Central Community College, where we're staying right now, is actually refused to meet with us today. So that's a concern for us about, you know, the longevity of our encampment. We're very concerned because of the bad publicity we got last week. But maybe now he's going to back off after he hears that the Seattle City Council is on our side. And I have to thank our own council member, Nick Licata, for introducing that resolution, which, by the way, and I have sent you a link, Tom, it's a very, very detailed review of the city's financial policies. So this is, like, really exciting for us in Seattle, and it's sad to see what's happening in Oakland and New York City, when right now in Seattle we're actually getting support from our local government and from our city council members.
That's spectacular. Mark, thanks a lot for the update, and good on you, and pass my regards along to everybody there. Thank you very much. Diana in Vancouver on the other end of Washington. Hey, Diana, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank God for you and Amy Goodman. And go Seattle, because I'm formerly of Seattle, but we had an Occupy Vancouver here rally, and we try to occupy on the weekends to not actually live in the park, but just to show support. Yep. I think that's increasingly important for people to have large support marches. What I'd like to say, too, is we send our young men and our young women to show other countries what democracy looks like, because they are so unfortunate as to be stripped of wealth and property, ignorant, without health care, without education. They have wealthy political regimes, and they are subject to the self-interest and the propaganda of the so-called media of those regimes. If they are allowed to vote, they often have inhibited access or rigged elections. And so we send our young men and our young women to show other countries what democracy looks like. And when that happens, even those of us who know what a true flag operation is, we display flags as patriots. And I would like to send a shout-out to everybody in this country to put up your flag, because it's a different type of battle, and we've got our Occupy people as our troops.
Yep, I think the American flag would make a great logo for the Occupy movement. The Tea Party adopted the Don't Tread on Me flag, which was the flag of America before the Constitution. It was the flag of America during the time of the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah.
And if we were to go back to that period, then you would not have child labor laws, and you would not have a federal right to impose them. You would not have anti-discrimination laws, nor a federal right to impose them. You would, arguably, you would not have the federal right to stop slavery in the states. And, you know, the Tea Party is so retrograde in that regard. And to use the Stars and Stripes as the logo for the Occupy movement, I think would take a lot of the wind out of the sails of those people who say that, it's a bunch of hippies, or, you know, they're not really patriotic Americans like I am.
Exactly.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
And open up conversation, because, you know, Sam next door is going to say, hey, what are you putting a flag up? Is it the 4th of July? You know, and I thought maybe we should put 99% on them, but don't, because then they would say, oh, well, you're that faction, or you support those. Oh, by the way, a newspaper referred to them as communists, people get these ideas, we all know. But displaying flags throughout the country, I think we need a visual show throughout the, something that people can see. You know, I also think we should progress with things like wear green if you have no health care today, you know, a visual display for people to see how many people out there truly, you know, support, because we need to open up conversation, because unfortunately, media such as, you know, a free media, true journalists do not exist in the corporate media. They should be embarrassed to call themselves that. And I think that this will help open up access of information to those who don't have, you know, the privilege of being able to view you on satellite.
I think you're right. Sarah, thank you very much for your comments and for what you had to say. And I think that you're absolutely right that protest or demonstration or whatever is, you know, it's part protest, it's part theater. And, you know, having a logo is great, and the American flag is a super logo.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. More with your thoughts right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 50 minutes past the hour. Frank in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Frank, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Yeah, thanks. It's interesting. You know, I'm a libertarian, so I agree with about one-fourth of what you progressives think, but almost only, and less than half of what the Republicans think, so it really isn't a home for us. However, but, you know, this Occupy Wall Street movement is really ridiculous the way you guys are handling this. I mean, I challenge, you know, I have a legal background myself, and I challenge anyone to point out how there is a constitutional right to take over public lands and live on them just under the name of a protest movement. For instance, would you be happy if a group of pro-lifers went to Zuccotti Park and camped out there for 2 months protesting against abortion, or gun owners going to a park in San Francisco and just pitching a shanty town there and saying they have a constitutional right to actually live there? Nobody's talking about taking away the right to protest and do anything like that. I mean, all you have to do is compare the Tea Party protests, which, you know, I agree again with about half or two-thirds of what the Tea Party wanted, but, you know, you just contrast the way they protested, the way this Occupy Wall Street group protests, and Occupy Wall Street looked like a bunch of immature children who...
So are you suggesting that the anti-abortion protesters who stand outside clinics day after day, week after week, and have been doing so for several decades now, that they don't have the right to do that?
They absolutely do, but they're not living there, and they're doing it with permits, and they're doing it within the guidelines of the regulations.
So your argument is that people should not be able to camp out.
Yes, and they should, and there's this you're hurting your own movement by thinking that there's some sort of entitlement to live in a park and do that simply because you're protesting.
I don't personally think that has been decided in this country, and your argument is not an irrational one. And it's going to be very interesting to see how this shakes out in New York and how it continues to shake out across the country. I'm not asserting an absolute right for any group to camp out anywhere forever. On the other hand, I'm really impressed by the by the sense of community that has come out of some of these groups. And we'll see where it goes. We'll see where it goes. Stephen in Burbank. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, Tom. I'm so glad you let the libertarian talk, because I had this as a meme. I was going to start with a different track, but it ties in perfectly. He mentioned children. Now, Jesus Christ said, the little children, you know, suffer them to come unto me.
Right.
And what is it about children? Unless you turn and become like these little ones, you shall in no wise enter into the realm. And here's what it is about children. They ask questions, and they only want to know the truth. And that's why he said that. Now, the question is, who do you think you're trying to fool? This is what the 99% are saying to the 1%. Who do you think you're trying to fool with debt, deficit, and austerity? Who do you think you're trying to fool, trying to tie in this meme that you have with money, dictating to us the value of our own humanity, our own human life?
Yeah. No,
what is the monetary value of the human life? And the statement is this. We know who you are, we know what you're doing, and we know why you're doing it. And so it's good that we're children. It's good that we ask the questions and try to seek the truth. I'm
got
sorry,
it, got it, Stephen. No, no, you have a very, very, very eloquent speech. Thank you. Greg in Warren, Michigan. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm not advocating armed revolution at this point in time, but there are times in history, and Nazi Germany is a good example, where when the fascists, and I'll use that term, you call them oligarchs, the corporatists, whatever, when they seize the reins of power and they reach a point where you are faced with loss of your rights, your constitutional rights, and you're close to a police state, which is where we're at in this country right now, sometimes the election process just takes too long. The fascists have...
So you want to bring back the Civil War?
No, I don't want to bring back the Civil War, and I don't want to see war at all, but I'm saying that if I'm in full support of the movement right now against Wall Street. I think it needs to get more organized and much stronger. Just simply waiting for elections is not going to do it anymore.
No, and this is the point I've been making over and over and over for years and years and years, is that movement politics is where everything begins. Although I would not take it to the point of saying let's repeat, you know, a war. Craig in Salina, Kansas. Hey, Craig, what's up?
Hey, one comment for your libertarian. I'm from the Berkeley area as a kid, and we were amateurs when we took on the Vietnam routine, and before it was over, that war ended.
Yeah.
My question, though, is that I haven't heard anything, and maybe you have some idea. Are any of these Occupy movements coming up with an idea for developing a political party itself?
No. To the best of my knowledge, no. And in fact, I think that may well be anathema to the relatively anarchic and flat, horizontal, small-d democratic principles on which they're founded, that they would gather together. Although, you know, the Tea Party wasn't supposed to be a party, and then it became a party, and now it's taken over the Republican Party. So who knows where it's going to go. Gene in Portland, last couple seconds here of the show. Quick comment.
I'm so glad I'm a contributor. As we've watched the occupiers in Portland, our heart is with them, but we're old and kind of frail, and we can't go out there. Mm-hmm. So I got to thinking about what could the rest of us do who really need to contribute to that. I put an American flag on my front door upside down. You know that's the international symbol of distress.
Yeah,
that's what the country's in.
I would be very careful. I would be very careful about doing that. It's, literally, that could bring police into your home concerned that you have a crisis. But holding the flag, you know, putting the flag up and putting a 99% next to it or something like that might be more appropriate. But, Gene, I'm with your sentiment. I personally wouldn't do that. But coming up tomorrow, it's a special Wednesday edition of Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, will be here talking about the important issues of the day and taking your calls, too. Plus, Vulture's Picnic in pursuit of petroleum pigs, power pirates, and high finance carnivores. We're going to talk with Greg Palast. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. Occupy something.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.